Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 138. And if you haven't already noticed, things will sound a little different today. Oh, I'm sorry. It's for Tuesday, May 1st. Ah, today is Tuesday, May 1st, May Day. Today is the big day that the anonymous people and anonymous supporters and Occupy people are supposed to make a big stink. We'll see how that goes. As you can hear, probably, things are a little different here at thebadquaker.com. At thebadquaker.com podcast headquarters, located in a secret hideaway in Springboro, Ohio, where everybody knows exactly where I'm at, because I'm not hiding anything about this. We have had ongoing construction in the neighborhood, and they, I talked about this on a podcast where it was actually the stupidity of the city that has caused the situation where the city now has to cough up huge amounts of money to replace a water main. Well, the city doesn't have to, do they? I mean, after all, they get the money free as much as they want using the extortion of the fist of the state. Anyway, so as they're cutting down the middle of the street to put in the new water line this morning, they clipped the electric main that connects my whole side of the neighborhood with the grid. So I am off grid right now. I have no computer access. Well, I have my laptop, but I have no internet access, and all the power is out and everything like that. Now, that's not a problem for me normally because we have backup for everything, but I'm not going to turn on, I'm not going to start generators and everything for a few hours here where they're just, they're going to have the power back on sometime today, I hope. So I'll give them a few hours before I do anything. The freezers are good and the refrigerators are good and all that kind of thing. And it's not supposed to be all that hot today. So we're running with the old style microphone that's battery operated, and this is a Handy Recorder H2, which is a nice little recorder. It's what I did all of the early recordings were done with this, and recently we did the kitchen podcast using this recorder. So it's a nice little recorder. I think it was a pretty good investment. It was like $250, if I recall. So what's happening in the news? I have no idea because I'm not on the internet. I did have some notes, though, that I didn't get to in yesterday's podcast, and I thought I would bring them up. And actually, this is kind of some stuff that's left over from last week, from a podcast last week. I was talking about how the market is actually what provides goods and services for us. The government really doesn't provide any goods and services. We think about things, we say, well, the government provides the roads, the government provides police force, the government provides, well, not really. If you understand really and truly what the market is the desires, is the practical outworking of the desires of people. People want something, they want a good or a service. And so because of that, they're willing to make certain sacrifices for that. And because some people are willing to sacrifice for it, other people are willing to step up and get paid to do those things, those services, or provide those products. And that's the essence of the market. Where the state comes in and where the aggression of government comes in is to interrupt that flow. So, for instance, let's say the roads. Well, roads have been supplied privately for thousands of years. And then in the last, in England, technically around the late 1600s, early 1700s, they started getting into road building a little bit. But really, in England, it wasn't up until in the 1800s that they really started getting into to road building. The U.S. didn't nationalize the roads, didn't socialize the roads until in the 1920s. There were already coast-to-coast highways. There was already highways from the Gulf Coast to Canada in the U.S., private roads, private highways that had been put in and were profitable from, what was it, Philadelphia to San Francisco and from the Gulf Coast to Canada, and all kinds of shorter roads and highways all across the United States were already in and functioning. And then in the 1920s, as the wave of progressive socialism came flooding into the United States, one of the things that the state did, as soon as the private road builders demonstrated their ability to make coast-to-coast highways, that sparked the lust of government, and they came in the 1920s and socialized the roads. Up to that time, in the United States, road building was not a government function. As a matter of fact, in the early 1800s, the government became fascinated with not really a new technology, but a rediscovered technology of canal building. And so then, you know, up in upstate New York and into Pennsylvania and well down into Ohio, the government became fascinated with building canals to move commerce and so forth like this. And they found out that they could tax the people, just wild taxation, to pay for these canal schemes. And a lot of people really didn't like that. As a matter of fact, you don't hear much talk about it, but it was one of the things that really irritated the southern states. You can hear the construction out there in the background, probably. It was one of the things that really irritated the southern states, was that the government in the north was taxing southern states through the tariff, through this unbelievable tariff they had to suffer, and they were using that money to improve the canal systems in the north, which brought in greater wealth to the factories in the north but did nothing for the south. So a lot of the southern states were very jealous about that their tax money was going pumping into New England and into Ohio and so forth. And the southern states were getting nothing in return. And the same thing was happening with the railroads. Government money was pumping into the railroads in the north, and the south got no railroads. They suffered having to build their own private railroads, or individual states trying to back railroad projects. So the south was underdeveloped in both the levels of railroad and canal building, because the North was, through this tariff, the North was taxing the South and then building it up there. Now, you might make the argument, well, see, the government was working in the North building those things, and the South business was failing by not providing them. Well, in a sense, it was the burden of the North that was adding to why the South couldn't afford to do those things. But in addition to that, in spite of the southern states' jealousy of being robbed, if you can look at it that way, their displeasure at being robbed so that the northern states could profit from canals, set the anger of the South aside about, you know, being robbed and so forth, and realize that the South is just crisscrossed with a network of good-sized rivers, and that allowed quite a bit of, and a wonderful coastline that much of the northern states lacked, especially in the days when you couldn't, you know, there wasn't a convenient way to get from Lake Superior, say, to the Hudson Bay. In those days, the northern states and what we now call the Midwest, it was very difficult to move goods around. But the South had such a good access to so many riverways and such a wonderful coastline that they hadn't really got to the point of where they needed canals or roads or railroads or whatever. Otherwise, the market would have provided them. But anyway, what I wanted to take that in a different direction. I really didn't mean to talk about the South or about that, but the example that I wanted to use in this is the example of automobiles in USSR, in Russia, in the Soviet Union, during the olden days when there was a Soviet Union. There was a lot of cars produced. The Soviets produced a lot of cars. Now, it was the government producing cars, you could say, because, of course, the Soviets controlled the auto industry entirely. It was an entirely socialist auto industry. Except, you see, really, it was the market providing cars. The only thing that the government did in socialist Russia was to disrupt the government, the market's ability to produce good cars and to produce them in a quantity that the market wanted. So in the West, where there was very little, relative to nowadays, there was very little influence of the government in the auto industry, at the same time, the Soviet Union, in the early days, in the 30s, when auto manufacturers were just exploding in the United States, and there was a variety of small companies making all kinds of different cars, in the Soviet Union, they weren't capable of doing that because the oppressive government was holding the market down to the point of where the market just couldn't supply that need. But there was still a great need for automobiles in the Soviet Union. So as time progressed, the market in the Soviet Union began providing cars, but it was so perverted by the government that you know, the cars were really, really bad, and the quantity wasn't the quantity that the market needed. So as the 50s rolled in, and as, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, but a lot of American tax money, right at the height of the Cold War, in the 50s and the 60s, right at the very height of the Cold War, lots and lots of American money was going into the Soviet Union to support the Soviet Union. That's not just a wild accusation. That's heavily documented. The John Birch Society and, you know, Mises talked about it quite a bit. There's quite a bit of support for that. But most American people didn't realize it. We would do things like the United States government would, first off, manipulate the wheat prices, and then the government would buy massive amounts of wheat from American farmers, and rather than allow it to go into the market, and rather than allow it have a normal effect on the American food market or on the international food market, they would send it to Russia, and there was a whole series of sweetheart deals that the United States government, while rattling their saber at the Soviet Union, sent the Soviet Union steel, sent the Soviet Union technology, sent them food. This was an ongoing thing all through, all the way back in the 30s. Most of the early equipment that the Soviet Union used to fight off the Germans in their initial invasion, either the equipment itself or the steel to produce the equipment, much of it was supplied by the U.S. And then even after World War II, when even the blindest eye could see that the Soviet Union was not our friends and they were not a good, you know, the thing that that the Roosevelt administration had tried to tell us that, oh, our Soviet friends are, you know, Uncle Joe over there in the Soviet Union. No, that was a really messed up government, and they were doing horrible atrocities, worse than Hitler, in the Soviet Union. And that was the people we were supporting, that government. Our tax dollars over here in the U.S. were going to support that government. Well, in the meantime, all this American tax money is flowing into the Soviet Union, and so they're beginning to have some degree of prosperity, not like the U.S. was having and not like Europe was having, but their auto market was able to actually start producing cars. So up into the 50s and 60s, there were cars being produced in the Soviet Union. Really, really bad cars. Horrible, ratty, ugly little cars that, you know, that were better than nothing. But that's all the market could provide because the market was so perverted by government influence. But one way or the other, it was still the market. People wanted it, and people supplied it. All the government did was get in the way. All the government did was distort the price mechanism and distort the quantity of production and these kind of things because in socialism there's no price mechanism. And so all that the Soviet Union could do was basically copy prices from the West and then try to set their production based on those copied prices. Now, this was the same with other things in the Soviet Union as well. The bread that was produced in the Soviet Union that kept the people alive was not produced by the government. It was produced by human beings. And it was consumed by human beings. There was no mystical state, with a giant bread machine popping out bread for all the Soviet people. The bread was being produced by human beings and consumed by human beings. And the exchange process that takes place between those people, between the grower of the wheat and the producer of the bread and the consumer of the bread, all those processes in between there were simply being perverted by the very existence of the Soviet government. Let's pause momentarily here. So I want to tie this back to what I was talking about when I first wrote these notes. If you think about the healthcare issue, that's what I was talking about, I believe, last week when I actually... As you can hear, I still have my phone and I still have text contact with the outside world. Sorry about the delay there. So anyway, okay, so maybe I can get by without a text message coming in. I would shut it off, except with us not having power and with people going in every direction. We've got Kai is down in Texas right now, and I kind of feel like I need to leave the thing on in case there's an emergency. Anyway, the topic that I was dealing with last week that got me thinking about all this was healthcare. The statement was, who made that statement? Was that? Oh my, I can't remember who made the statement. Might have been Bob Higgs or somebody made the statement last week that I quoted on a podcast, that if you think we can't afford doctors and hospitals and medication and healthcare, then how can we afford doctors and hospitals and medication and healthcare plus the giant bloated government bureaucracy that's going to go with it and inflict it on everybody and the massive amounts of taxes that are going to have to pay for it all? So really what you're looking at here is you have the market supplying something. And currently, in the United States, that the healthcare market is horribly distorted by the government already. It has been for a long time. And in addition to that, the government is constantly, even without the Obamacare and without Bush's infractions on the free market, even without all that, it seems like daily the government is expanding more and more into healthcare. But it's the market that's providing these things. All the government is doing is interfering in the exchange. They come in and they set regulations and they distort the prices and they, add layers of bureaucracy that don't need to be there, and they force insurance on people who might or might not want that particular type of insurance. And all these things, all these acts of aggression, they don't provide any actual service. All they do is disrupt the service that you would normally have from the market. And that's the same thing that was happening in the Soviet Union with healthcare. There was a market for it. There were people who needed healthcare, and there were people who were skilled and could provide it or wanted to provide it. And the only role that the government really provided in the Soviet Union was to interrupt that process, was to interrupt the market. And so that's what we face here as the government in the U.S. Attempts to place itself into the market in an even more aggressive fashion than it already has. I want to take that in a slightly different direction. Now, I was having a discussion, I was having this same discussion with several different people on several different locations at the same time. And sometimes it's very frustrating. When a person believes something, let's say, for instance, I'll pick a goofy thing. Let's say you believe that chewing gum is evil. Now, if you believe that chewing gum is evil, then There must be some kind of reason that you believe this. Do you believe chewing gum is evil because someone you respect told you that chewing gum is evil? Do you believe chewing gum is evil because you tried chewing gum and you bit your tongue and so therefore chewing gum is evil? Do you believe chewing gum is evil because, I mean, there has to be some reason so that you can make an argument in your mind to say, I believe chewing gum is evil because this, this, and this. If you believe something, chewing gum is evil, and you have no logical reason why you believe it, then you set yourself up to make mistakes in logic and to judge other things wrong as well. Now, for the sake of the discussion here, chewing gum might be evil. But if you don't have a reason for why you believe that, then it's almost as though it doesn't matter whether it's evil or not. The fact is you're just following what someone else told you, or you're following a myth, or you're following something that you have no reason to, or no actual reason that you know why to believe this thing. So if you're going to believe that chewing gum is evil, you need to explain why you think that it's evil. Otherwise, you know, you can look really silly if you then go out and try to explain to other people that chewing gum is evil. You if you don't have a basis as to why you believe this. And now, to get specific on this, the thing that's being trumpeted, and this is going to be the theme for today with all the Occupy people that are all over the place making a big stink over May Day, there's so much of an emphasis, and it's coming so much from the media, and we hear it from the government, and this is the excuse of the 2008 crash. It's all blamed on greed. It's greed. It's greed. It's all, it's because of greed. Greed is evil. It's because of greed. Many of these Occupy people and many of the anonymous people, they are filled in their minds with confidence that the problem is greed. And yet, everyone I've talked to can't really explain why that is. They can give examples of where greed was bad, but then I can give examples of where greed has produced good and didn't do any harm. And typically, that just makes them angry. Typically, they will not stop and analyze why it is that they believe what they believe. Instead, they just jump back to, well, I believe this is, and greed is evil. Everybody knows greed is evil. Well, is greed evil? Why do you believe that? Do you believe it because the media tells you? Do you believe it because the government has announced it almost nonstop since the crash happened in 2008? Do you believe greed is the source of the problem in our government? And do you believe greed is the source of the problem with Wall Street? And do you believe greed is the source of the problem in the markets internationally and in Greece and in Spain and in England? And do you believe greed is what is driving the problem in Syria or in Egypt? Do you believe greed really is the source of all this? Why? Why do you believe that? Is it because the government tells you? Is it because the media tells you? Is it because a 15th century thinker, because a 15th century a person who we're supposed to announce as a saint, just because somebody put a title on him, is that why we're supposed to believe greed is the source of all these problems? Because here's two scenarios. You have a baby. You're holding a baby in your arms. And the baby has drank all the milk that the baby needs to drink. And this could be, you know, hopefully, I'm a supporter of breastfeeding. I think it's a wonderful, the most healthy way to feed a young child, if you can. I realize that's, oops, bumping things here. I realize that's not always possible in all cases. So however the child is nursing, or however the child is drinking milk, the child gets to a point of where the child has drank all the milk. But the child naturally wants more. As a matter of fact, a lot of babies that I've been around, including the three that I raised, my wife and I raised, when a baby gets full, they will just keep drinking until they throw up. So you have to monitor how much they're drinking, and when they get to where you know their little belly is full, then you take them away and you pat them on the back and you let them burp a little bit. And if they still have that desire to nurse, you can stick a pacifier in their mouth and they'll just suck away on that pacifier until they sort of relax a little bit and they wear themselves down some and they overcome that powerful urge to nurse. And then they relax and go to sleep, or they, you know, you can play with them or whatever that happens next. But you get that out of their mind once they get enough sucking to where they're satisfied. And then you can distract them with either play, or you can, you know, or they can go to sleep or whatever. Now, when a child is nursing, and when a child gets its little belly full, and when it continues to frantically desire to nurse, that's greed. The child is wanting more than it needs. That's greed. The child is wanting so much as to make itself sick. That's greed. But how can we argue that that is evil? That seems silly. Who is harmed? If the child is nursing to the point where it's full, and the parent is watching, and the parent switches the child over to a pacifier, and the child sucks on the pacifier for a few minutes, and we're assuming that the pacifier is not a problem, and the child's, you know, 4 years old and still sucking on a pacifier. As long as the pacifier doesn't become a problem, and as long as the parents are able to maintain a balance, the greed of the child has harmed no one, has not harmed the child, has not harmed the parents, and has done no harm. So how can it be bad? How can bad not harm? Now here's another scenario. This was a scenario that I used a couple times over the last week. Let's say you have a man, and this man is a shepherd, and there's a contest, a very famous contest, and the winner of this contest is judged by all the shepherds around the world as the greatest shepherd of all. If this man is a good enough shepherd, he'll win this contest, and all his fellow shepherds will acknowledge his greatness. And this shepherd begins to become very, very greedy, and he wants that glory. He wants glory. That's it fills his mind. He wants glory so bad it drives him. And so he becomes almost fanatical to try as hard as he can to try to develop the very best strain of sheep that he can develop, and to develop the very, very best strain of wool that he can develop, so that he can win recognition from all the other shepherds around the world that he is the greatest shepherd ever. And so this greed of his, this greed for glory, it's a pure greed for glory. It drives him to be meticulous with his flock. And he makes sure, and he combs and he brushes each lamb, and he looks at its fur, and it's wool. He looks at its wool on every single sheep and every single lamb, and he is just meticulous with the raising of these sheep and with the breeding of the sheep until he produces his own breed of sheep that produce a better wool than anyone has ever produced. And a breed of sheep that is hardy and requires very, very little attention on the part of the shepherd, and that also produces a better consistency in the meat production. So he has, with his obsession at winning this contest, with his complete level of greed for the glory of winning this contest, he has produced a breed of sheep that he will receive worldwide glory for. And that breed of sheep also produces better meat, better wool, and sheep with less maintenance for the shepherd. Now, in this scenario, greed drove this man. Greed drove him to produce a better product. And so the market is better. Individual consumers are better. He certainly is better off for it because now he wins the glory and the recognition that he's desired his whole life. And so he is satisfied by his greed. His greed has brought him fame and fortune. His greed has produced a better product in the market than was there before. His greed has allowed people to eat better than they did before and to clothe themselves better than they did before. And his greed allowed a breed of sheep into the market that reduces the amount of labor that other shepherds have to produce a better product. And so how did his greed produce anything bad? How is his greed bad? Didn't his greed do good? Well, it's often said two wrongs can't make a right. I would argue one wrong can't make a right. Two wrongs can't make a right. 10 wrongs can't make a right. You can't do good from doing bad. You can't have a good result in the long run from doing bad. The net result will always be bad. You might, if you do bad, you might get a little bit of good, but the net result will always be more bad than you started out with. So, if greed is bad, what aspect of the baby story is bad? What aspect of the shepherd story is bad? Therefore, greed is just an emotion. Greed is just an emotion like any other emotion. It's a thing inside your head. It's a thing you think. It's a thing perhaps that drives you, if you let it. But it's just an emotion. It's thoughts. And you see, thoughts are not the reason the stock market crashed in 2008. Thoughts are not the reason governments are corrupt. Thoughts are not the reason Wall Street steals from people on a daily basis. Thoughts are not the reason the economy is going down the toilet. It's not because of thoughts. It's because of the aggression. The aggression of those that I refer to as the state being that larger entity that makes a place in the market for, not really the market, that was a bad choice of words. The state is that belief that aggression can be used. And then once you believe that and you allow government to use that aggression, and that aggression corrupts business, and that aggression corrupts all industries that it touches. And so the media, the mainstream media, is corrupt because of government aggression. Aggression being not just a thought, but actual actions that people take. Stuff people do causes evil. Not just a thought. Aggression is really what the problem is. When you eliminate the aggression, what a person thinks is beside the point. What drives a person is beside the point. Whether their act is good or bad is based on whether there's aggression involved. A person can have all kinds of thoughts in their head, but do they aggress? If they haven't aggressed, then they haven't harmed anyone. I can think in my mind, I can have all kinds of horrible, nasty thoughts in my mind. But if I don't act upon those thoughts in a negative way, if I don't actually aggress upon someone, then all they are is thoughts. And now those statists who would love to arrest us for our thoughts are the same people who are trying to tell us that greed is the source of the financial problems in the world, that greed is the thing that we have to hate, that greed is... But yet, I demonstrated two cases of where greed actually, in one case, is neutral, and in another case, actually produced a good. Okay, I think I've beat that enough. I don't think I need to continue to expound upon it. Another thing that I'm seeing, you know, I've done so many podcasts talking about the Constitution that sometimes I feel guilty talking about the Constitution so much. And then I look around on the internet and I see people worshiping the Constitution, bowing before it, acting like it's some holy writ. And I just hold my forehead and shake my head and moan. How can people glorify an object to raise a simple piece of paper up to the point of being godlike, that they put so much faith in it. And this silly piece of paper has let them down so bad over the years. The same person on the internet who is proclaiming how if we could just get back to the Constitution, we have to defend the Constitution, we have to defend the Constitution. Why? Wasn't the Constitution supposed to defend us? And it hasn't done that. Well, it's because people need to do this and people need to do that. Well, if people need to do this and that, then what do they need the Constitution for? I mean, you know, you're wanting to have it both ways. You want to write a magic piece of paper that somehow controls government. And then you want to have the people who are out here being oppressed by government to control government. Well, if the people are going to control government, what do we need the paper for? And if the paper is going to control government, what do the people need to get involved for? You see, here's the thing of it. The problem is not the paper, and the problem is not the people not upholding the paper. The problem is people believing that a government can exist through the use of aggression, and you can somehow keep that government to a certain size, and that it's not going to overgrow. That's where the real problem lies. This myth that you can give one small group of people the ability to steal, to come out and just take your property as much as they want, anytime they want, you're going to give people this kind of ability and they're not going to expand on it? You believe that just a piece of paper is going to cause those people to stop what they're doing and back up? Has it ever done that? Do you see that in Congress? 500 and some people on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. And there's, what, one or maybe two that you could argue that are even close to consistent to sticking with this document? And if you count all of them over the course of the last 200 and whatever years, 200 and, you know, almost 40 years, no, since the Constitution was written, it's 230 some years. But either way, if you count up all of those people who have ever been in the U.S. government during that entire time frame, how many really consistently upheld that Constitution? You can fit them in one small bathroom. The vast majority of those people were just crooks. That's all they were. They're just thieves. They're there to get cush jobs for their friends. They're there to get their own glory. They're there to manipulate people and to accomplish the things that they want to get accomplished at the expense of other people's labor. So in all those years, When did the Constitution work? It never did. This idea that, well, things used to be great up until this or up until that. Things were great until Obama came along. Really? What, have you been in a coma? Things were great until George Bush came along. Really? Were you asleep during the Clinton years? Well, things were great until Clinton got here. Really? Ask the people in Panama about that. Well, things were great under Ronald Reagan. Were they really? When Ronald Reagan was saying we need to stick to the Constitution, shrink the government, and the government's not not the answer, the government's our friend, and when he was raising taxes over and over and saying that he wouldn't raise taxes, in that time, is that when? When government just exploded in size, is that when? When Jimmy Carter was violating the Constitution like it was nothing? When go back to poor old Ford, wasn't in there very long, so I hate to pick on him, pathetic little guy that he was. Nixon, is anybody going to defend Nixon as a champion of the Constitution? LBJ? Are we going to think LBJ? I'm going back step by step. Let's all bow before the idol of Kennedy. Why? Why? Let's make up legends about Kennedy, how great he was. Why? He was just another leech like all the rest. And what about Eisenhower before him? Shall we bow before the idol of Eisenhower? The great Eisenhower who threw us into debt for generations for his pet road project. And now I go back to the beginning of the podcast again. Let's talk about roads. Eisenhower didn't just spend money on roads. Eisenhower pushed through a program that put that took out permanent recurring loans that would never be paid off, still haven't been paid off from the 50s. The road loans still haven't been paid off. Generation after generation paying for the highways that never, with unending construction, filling the pockets of a very small group of people at the cost of the taxpayers. And would the roads have been created? Would the roads have happened without? Maybe. Maybe the roads would have been created. Maybe we wouldn't need roads. Maybe if it weren't all the tax money that was sunk into the roads under Eisenhower and in the generations afterwards, maybe if it wasn't for all that tax money sucked out of the economy, maybe we wouldn't need roads today. Maybe there'd be some other method. We don't know. See if I can get back to my notes a little bit here. So then, back to the Constitution. So why should we defend this Constitution? Wasn't the Constitution, I'll read a little bit from my notes here, wasn't the Constitution the thing that was supposed to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty? Now, all myths aside, the Constitution was written by a small group of elites to fool the commoners into believing that the new federal government would be held down and kept small and weak. That's the truth. You don't believe me? Listen to what Richard Henry Lee had to say about the Constitution. This was in a letter to George Mason dated October 1st, 1787. Richard Henry Lee called the Constitution the deviousness of Congress's action. Because, you see, Congress met to make minor adjustments to the Articles of Confederation. That was the purpose. That's what they were going to do. And instead, part of them arrived early, had a separate convention, excluded the others that they didn't want into their group, and drafted the Constitution. You didn't read that in your high school history book, did you? But that's what they did. Okay, now let's look at what someone else said. Samuel Bryan, October 5th, 1787, called the Constitution a most daring attempt to establish a despotic aristocracy. A most daring attempt to establish a despotic aristocracy. And Samuel Bryan said that it was written for, and this is a quote, the interests of the well-born few. You see, he read the thing and he realized this is a tool to bring us into subjugation just exactly like we were under England. The same people that were our rulers want to now be our rulers again, now that we're free of England. The same big shots in what used to be the colonies now want to be the big shots in a federal government. William Findlay, on November 6th, 1787, called the Constitution a most daring attempt to establish a despot. Oops, nope, that's Samuel Bryan's quote. Let's see. William Findlay, November 6th, 1787, called the writers of the Constitution a set of aspiring despots who will make us their slaves. Now, you're not, unless you're a history geek like me, you probably are not familiar with William Findlay and Samuel Bryan and maybe not even Richard Henry Lee. But here's a different name that maybe you'll recognize. Thomas Jefferson said this. He wrote this in a letter to William Stephen Smith on November 13th, 1787. Now, that was after the War of Independence. So keep this in mind. This is after the War of Independence. Jefferson is writing to William Stephen Smith, and he says this: the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Now keep in mind, he was referring to those gentlemen who had just drafted the Constitution, and he was referring to them trying to push the Constitution on the free people. That's a quote that's often quoted, and a lot of people know that Jefferson said that. But most people, I think, believe that he was talking about breaking free from England. But when he said that phrase, he was saying it specifically against adopting the Constitution, because Jefferson realized what it was. George Mason, in his objections to the Constitution, wrote November 22, 1787, he said that America, under the Constitution, would be, quote, a corrupt, oppressive aristocracy. George Mason said that. Now, it is true that eventually many of these people compromised, and they looked at the situation. Hamilton and his despots were well in control. The freedom, the liberty-minded of the what are called the Founding Fathers, were in a desperate situation. They had, they did not have the big banking backers that the Federalists had. And so they were desperate, and they were losing. And so they compromised. They compromised, and some were bought out. As a matter of fact, there was a Boston newspaper, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but there was a Boston newspaper that right in the midst of attempting to get the Constitution ratified, the Boston newspaper quoted names and quoted sources and said that a huge influx of money is coming in from the bankers buying off the delegates to try to ratify this Constitution. I believe it was the Boston Globe, if I recall correctly, that reported that. Big headlines that the delegates were being bought off by the banking interests. You see, there's nothing new under the sun. Everything that is, it was of old. And the things that you see, they've been here right along. The corruption that takes place when you hand people the authority to act aggressively and without impunity, this causes the corruption of government. It's the aggression. It's not the greed. Greed is simply a thought. A person can have lust, a person can have greed, a person can have envy. And if those things are sins, that's between them and God. But if they don't act upon those things, they have not harmed another human. And so no human has the right to judge them on those things. So if a person holds deep within them lust, envy, hate, greed, any of these things we're told to demonize, if a person holds those thoughts deep within them and they never harm anyone, then no human has the right to judge them. And if you really believe those things are evil, then you're stuck placing yourself in the position of God, judging them on what goes through their mind. As a matter of fact, isn't that kind of what was described as the fall of Lucifer? That he wanted to ascend on high and become like the Most High? Well, when you judge your fellow man, isn't that what you're doing? When you judge the thoughts and the mind and the heart and the intentions of someone who has not acted and not actually done anything to anyone else, when you judge what's in a person's mind, are you not placing yourself as their judge, as their God, aren't you putting yourself in the position of God? Aren't you becoming the lawmaker, making up the laws and putting yourself onto the throne? Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening.